This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk about being a second officer and an expat with a major Asian airline. In the news, we look at families of MH370 victims taking the search into their own hands, a study of a new flight approach pattern, a WASP T6 trainer in a film, a looming strike at Chicago O'Hare, and a Susie story. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 428 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is first Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Max. I hope everyone's doing well out there in listener land. And I know we're not supposed to talk about the weather, but it rained for the first time in Southern California in what seems like 5 years. So we're just so incredibly happy that the ground got wet. So,
you needed that, didn't you?
Yeah. Oh, and we need so many more weeks of rain. Yeah.
All right.
So it was great to see it.
And also with us is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Hi. Looks like Skype's working tonight.
Oh,
unlike last week.
Last week was kind of a nightmare, but so far so good. Also with us is Rob Mark. He's a senior editor at Flying Magazine, a flight instructor and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, hi, guys. Is it true that tonight's going to be a turkey of a show?
I guess one can
hope. Yeah. Maybe not. You know, some people in some of the survey responses said that I sounded a bit cranky at times. I'm not going to be that way anymore because I see this as a mandate to get back to writing jokes. What do you guys think?
Oh, this will be the last survey.
God help us.
Well, speaking of the survey, I started doing some analysis, but quite fortunately, many of you have continued to submit your responses, your feedback via our survey. So since the responses are still coming in, I'll hold off another week or so before we release the results, which are kind of interesting. In the meantime, we have a guest this episode, of course. Our guest is Andy Bard. Andy is a second officer at a major Asian airline. He currently flies the Airbus A330 and A350. Now, he's in his first flying job. He's originally from Northern Europe, and Andy now considers himself a lifetime expat. For the last 15 years, he's worked all over the world in sales and office jobs before giving it all up to pursue a career as an airline pilot. Andy, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, what made you decide that you wanted to jump into the pilot seat?
Well, I've always loved aviation, and it was something that, you know, one of those things that you sort of start reaching middle age and you say, well, I wish I'd done that when I was 20. And a few of my friends were pilots, and they said, you know, there are opportunities. And so I started investigating and talked to a couple of airlines, and in the end went off and got my commercial license, and then a few years later managed to get hired. So it's a bit of an unusual situation in Asia, since we don't have that very strong general aviation community that you would have in, say, the US or Australia or even in Europe. These opportunities still exist, even if you're not 22 and, you know, bushy-tailed anymore.
Okay. Well, we're going to get into some more detail on that, learn about what a second officer is and what it's like to fly in Asia. Before we do that, we're going to talk about some of the recent aviation news from the past week. So I'm going to ask, is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready. And Rob's on mute, as always.
Oh, that's why. I was going to say, that's why nobody answered me when I said that. Okay, yes, I'm ready to.
All Our first story comes from firstpost.com. This is MH370, families of those aboard missing aircraft to mount a debris hunting trip to Madagascar. Now, I think all of us know six pieces of wreckage from Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 have been found on the coast of Madagascar. I guess some of those were positively identified as coming from MH370. Others were almost certainly from that aircraft. Well, there's a family association that's called Voice 370. And they say, quote, "There has been no systematic, organized search by any responsible party. This leaves the next of kin no other choice except to take it upon ourselves to do something to find answers and closure." So as a result, four Malaysians, two Chinese, and a French next of kin are planning a trip, a self-financed trip to Madagascar in December. This is, Rob, this is almost kind of surprising to me that, you know, it would fall on the families of the missing passengers to conduct this kind of a search, this kind of an operation. What do you think about that?
Well, it has been 2.5 years since the airplane disappeared. And what was the phrase they used? There's been no systematic organized search.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'll bet you the folks in Australia would probably not be real happy to hear that, because they think they have been conducting a systematic and organized search. Now, I'll grant you, they have not found the airplane. And the pieces that have washed up aren't anywhere even close to the area that they're searching. But again, I don't know that it means that there hasn't been anybody looking, because the Australian government's spent quite a bit of money trying to find them. And again, I think that really all we can do is say, look, we're sorry that that you feel like you've got to go spend your own money to do this, but there's always the chance they're going to come upon something that nobody else found. I mean, I don't know if there is much of a presence in Madagascar that has been mounted at all. You know, maybe somebody doing some, you know, one-on-one detective work. But I guess all we can do is wait and see, because what we're doing isn't working, and they have not found it. Of course, myself, I don't think they will, but again, it certainly can't hurt to try.
Andy, flying in that region, you must have maybe some of your own thoughts or some comments as to what other pilots in that region kind of think of MH370 and what's been happening and all. Any comment on that?
Well, certainly. Firstly, regarding the actual statement about there being no systematic search, I think there's a bit of a cultural thing there where in East Asia, maybe the some of the nuances are different in how people speak. So the way that statement is phrased doesn't sound unusual to me. I will say, in summary, the ocean is a big place. And even flying much closer to land, I mean, you can lose a lot of stuff down there without ever finding it. And I think maybe someday in the future we will find debris if they keep looking. But, you know, it's an enormous search area. There's not a lot of traffic there. And if somebody wants to lose something, which in many pilots' opinion is what happened, somebody wanted to get lost or somebody wanted to crash the airplane, then it might be very, very difficult to find something. On the other hand, if they want to try to do some searching, knock yourselves out.
Yeah, and I think they intend to focus on, again, the you know, the coastline on Madagascar there, hopefully looking for or hopefully finding some additional pieces of the plane maybe that would provide some more clues as to what might have happened. You sort of have to feel, well, not sort of, I think you definitely feel for these families and all of this time that's gone by and not having answers, not knowing what's happening. It's got to be tough for them. But I understand the ocean search is kind of nearing its conclusion. The article says that, Rob, you mentioned sort of the price of conducting this kind of search, and they put it at $160 million U.S. that's been expended in looking for the airplane. But a lot of money, but a lot of time, a lot of effort, certainly a lot of ocean that's, it hasn't yielded its secrets, I guess.
Yeah, and it says that they covered 46,000 square miles. That's an awful lot of ocean.
It sounds like a lot, but I mean, there's more out there, yeah. More ocean. Yeah. And I think two things here are that the $160 million compared to the price of a new 777 isn't that much. Also, because we could go on and spend much, much more than that. And in the end, if you get a positive answer saying this was pilot action, this was mechanical fault or something else, this would be valuable, which is why the AF-447 investigation went on for so long. Yes. The other thing is also the disconnect that we as pilots or people who are interested in the industry understand about how things work, but you talk to the typical layman and it's very easy to misunderstand how difficult these things are. Even in such a modern world, I can have Google Maps taking me everywhere. How can you possibly lose an airliner? And how can you possibly disconnect safety systems and so forth? Why does this exist? Because the answers are not that simple to explain, really.
Yes. Yes, it is difficult to communicate to the general public just what all the issues are and the concerns. All right, let's take a look at our next item. And this comes from AOPA, titled AOPA Air Safety Institute and UND Study Stabilized Approach. So this is the UND, the University of North Dakota, in conjunction with the AOPA Air Safety Institute. They're studying the use of a continuous turning approach or a circular pattern as an alternative to the traditional box or rectangular traffic pattern. Now, this idea came out of a recent loss of control panel where it was thought that changing the landing pattern might actually improve safety and reduce loss of control accidents. Rob, when we look at this, can you maybe explain sort of the difference between a rectangular traffic pattern and a circular pattern?
Well, one has kind of square corners and one has no corners at all.
So basically it's, you know, do you square?
Basically.
No, seriously.
Basically, it's a carrier approach.
You know, it kind of is. Minus the overhead. And one of the reasons that they're doing that, I think, from having read this, is that stall spins are still a big problem. And the reason people can get into a stall spin situation and that they have is that when they make that last turn from the base leg, a nice square turn, as we call it, to the final approach, and if they're not compensating properly for the wind, or they're a little too fast, or they're a little too slow on the controls, they can look like they're going to overshoot the runway, and people will sometimes kick in bottom rudder, which is essentially the rudder in the turn. If you're making a left turn, it'd be the left rudder. And if you do it hard enough and fast enough, you can basically get the inside wing to stall, and you're gone. And I've experienced it in an aerobatic airplane up higher where we were testing it, and it's amazing how quickly it can happen. So their concept, I believe, is that if it's a continuous approach, there won't be this need to roll the wings level, then decide when to start the turn and when to roll out and when to use rudder and when not. It's going to be one smooth maneuver from the minute they get opposite the end of the runway before they start back towards the airport. And maybe it'll work. We don't know for certain, but it's certainly a unique approach.
Yeah, Rob, to me, by looking at the picture, it seems like the angle that you're turning is much less sharp by doing the circular pattern.
Oh, absolutely. So, well, especially if you're on top of the airplane. Let me rephrase that. That sounds kind of stupid. You're not on top of it. You're inside of it. But what I meant is that you don't let the airplane get ahead of you. And again, it doesn't seem that tough to to most of us that have been making these square patterns all our lives. But again, if you let the airplane kind of get ahead of you or the wind pushes you the wrong way, you can find yourself in a situation where the best thing to do would probably be to pour the coals to it and go around and come back and do it again. And that's where a lot of the stall spins have happened. But in answer, I'm sorry, that's a long answer to a short question, Brian. But yes, we wouldn't be making 90 degree turns anymore. It looks like you could probably make this with about a 30 degree bank all the way around, and you know, it's seriously would be easier to maneuver to the final approach if you were already in a turn, even with the wind behind you, than it would be. When you're trying to make that box pattern.
Well, let me ask the stupid question. What's the logic behind the box pattern, the rectangular pattern? Why didn't we do a circular approach from the beginning?
Well, the military, as David pointed out, the military always has. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, it would be interesting to see what kind of statistics military pilots have had in training in terms of stall spin accidents versus civilian pilots that are flying the box pattern. And I don't know that I've ever seen that, but why do we do it? Because that's the way everybody did it. And it's kind of the same as talking about high altitude stall training. Why didn't pilots learn that the first thing to do was to reduce the angle of attack, or essentially lower the nose? Well, because they just didn't. And sometimes there just aren't good answers other than this is the way they've always done it.
I've gone from one to the other. When I learned to fly, I did the rectangular pattern. And then during airline training, when we were on the light twin, I started doing one, and my instructor went, no. In the twin, we do a circular pattern. And I sort of looked at him and went, well, you're going to have to demonstrate that. I will say it does decrease workload a bit, because you're already in the turn. All you have to do is make the increase or decrease the bank angle, really, depending on wind or depending on if you were a bit late. So instead of sort of straightening out and now your final notch of flap or whatever, and then coming out again, that last turn is just much, much smoother. And it's easier to adapt your bank angle than it is to decide, well, I'm now straight and level. Now I've got to rethink into going to a turn, and then I've got to go straight and level again. So I must say there could be something to this decreasing workload bit. But honestly, I didn't find the rectangular pattern that hard either.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, this study is ongoing, according to the AOPA article. Both the UND and the Air Safety Institute figure that they'll have some results available sometime early 2017. So when those results are available, the results of that study, we'll take a look at what they say. Now, of course, this kind of comes up because we've talked in past years about how the NTSB publishes a, quote, most wanted list each year. And AOPA also reports, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes as well, that general aviation loss of control is still on the NTSB most wanted list. That's the third year, I guess, that it's been up there. NTSB says, quote, better training on how to eliminate distraction, avoid stalls, and manage weather issues will put pilots back in control and give them better command of their outcomes. So the article also points out, kind of interestingly, that the general aviation accident rate has dropped quite a bit, actually. Back in 1994, the accident rate per 100,000 flight hours was 8.45. And then in 2015, it dropped to 4.66. So that's quite a bit. And also the fatal accident rate dropped from 1.73 to 0.89. In that same time period. So it does show some improvement, but I guess there's a way to go, Rob.
There's always room for improvement. I mean, we've improved, let's be serious, you know, until just recently in the United States, we still had loss of control issues that we were dealing with on the airline side. And we've gotten pretty good at that, at dealing with it. It's not fixed, I'm sure, but We look at other countries that are still dealing with it. I mean, Emirates lost a 777 in Dubai last summer when the crew kind of botched the go around and the airplane fell out of the sky. With you know, it just happens, and people say, well, why wouldn't the pilot do this or do that? Well, that's the big question, and so it is an improvement, and it that's all we can do is keep aiming at that 0 point.
All right, we have an item from The Guardian. This is called The Ups and Downs of Being an Airline Pilot, and this really isn't a news story per se, but it does contain some interesting aspects, I think, about being a notable airline pilot. One of the examples is concerning Patrick Smith. Now, that name sounds familiar. He was our guest in episode 410. Patrick is an airline pilot, a blogger, and an author. You'll recall he writes the Ask the Pilot website. He's also written that New York Times best-selling book, Cockpit Confidential. But this article relates an encounter he had with a TSA agent and the supervisors over basically a butter knife, airline cutlery that was in his bag, and he was questioned about that. It was confiscated from him. He was in uniform, by the way, and just found it somewhat kind of ironic that, first of all, he's the captain, so what's he going to do, hijack himself with his butter knife? The other thing is, you know, when he explained to them when they confiscated the knife that, well, you know, in a few minutes when he's on the plane, he'll just get another one. That sort of set off the bells and alarms and resulted in kind of, well, a little bit more of an extended trip through the security process than he had originally expected. Andy, have you ever encountered any kinds of issues going through airport security or anything like that, despite maybe wearing the pilot's uniform?
Oh, sure. There are some places where they just say, they cut you a bit of slack and, oh yeah, so I have this bottle of shampoo and it's no big deal. And other places, I would say the Middle East notably, where, you know, you just have to strip down to your underwear and like the zippers will set it off and the little clips on your uniform and things like that. So it's very regional. But also, I have a friend who used to have a beard and he always got stopped. And now he's shaved it off and he never gets stopped. So
interesting.
These things exist and they don't really, you know, just because you're a pilot, they'll still check you. They're doing their job. They, you know, so to be fair, they are doing their job and I don't feel like getting into an argument. I'll just do what they say because I need to go and do my job. However, it's definitely something that we encounter as well as the average passenger. On the other hand, on the plus side, we get to cut in line. So I think on the whole, it's okay.
Yeah, small price to pay for being able to cut in line.
Indeed. Well, you know, when I heard this, I was kind of surprised, actually, that a guy who has been flying in the system here in the U.S. for as long as he has kind of seems surprised that when they pulled a knife, call it airline cutlery, okay, but it's to a TSA agent that doesn't know this guy, that doesn't know for certain that he's not some guy that dressed up in a pilot's uniform, pulling a knife out of a bag and having the guy say, well, look, when I get past you guys, I'm going to get another one anyway. I could sort of understand where the TSA person might say, oh, you know, this is ringing some bells on me here.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. But I think also as pilots, we have good days and bad days. Some days you're like super excited to get to work and some days you're a bit tired and you wished you could have stayed in bed, especially because it's 2 a.m. and you're tired. So I think that also has something to do with it. And some people have a more confrontational personality than others. And you know, in the end, yes, they're doing their job, but you're tired.
Yeah. Pilots are normal people, too.
Indeed.
All right. Let's take a look at the next item. Rob, you wrote a story in Flying Magazine. The CAF wants to restore WASP T6 trainer and fund film. This is kind of an exciting article, I think. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what the story is here?
Well, when this came across my desk the other day, it mentioned Elaine Harmon, who is a name that some history buffs may recall from just a couple of months ago. Elaine Harmon was a WASP, I can say elderly because of my age, but Elaine was a WASP pilot during the Second World War, and like probably more than 20,000 of her comrades, flew everything the U.S. military put into the sky. The only thing they didn't do is they didn't fly them in combat. They flew them on maintenance runs. They ferried the airplanes. And, of course, they had to learn to fly in order to do that. And this T-6 that is that the Commemorative Air Force found is not just a T-6. It is one of the T-6s that they tracked via its serial number to the training pool down in Texas where a lot of these ladies learned to fly. And the reason this all came together for Elaine Harmon, who had passed away a few months ago at age 95, was that there was a big story that they would not, the U.S. government would not allow her to be buried at Arlington National Cemetery. And just to make a long story short, there were other WASPs who were buried at Arlington, and people just could not figure out why they wouldn't let her family have her buried there. And as it turned out, all of the WASPs that were buried at Arlington were buried next to their husbands, who were also military officers. And Elaine didn't have a husband who was in the military. And the government said, no, sorry. And the family just really took umbrage with that and did some political work and got some support from Congressman McSally out in Arizona, who is the one of the, I think, if not the, David, maybe you know this. Was she the first lady to fly in combat for the U.S.?
I don't think so.
Okay. Anyway, that's kind of what I was told. But, hey, we'll see. But anyway, so they got a special law passed that said any WASP who makes application or whose family makes application can be buried at Arlington. And so this all kind of came together for the Commemorative Air Force at the time they found the T-6, and they said, wow, this could be a great opportunity to make it an educational tool as well. And they thought, wow, imagine if we had a movie that talked about the WASPs. So that's what they're trying to fund as well. And Sigourney Weaver has already signed on to be the narrator for the film when it's finished. And so they're up. You know, they've got their Kickstarter program up there, and I'm sure we'll probably put that in the show notes or people can find the information at flyingmag.com. And if you want to make a donation toward that first 100,000 that they're trying to raise, I think they were at 70,000 or something when I last looked. But again, it's a good cause. It's a good story. And we want to make sure that these ladies aren't forgotten. I was lucky enough to know one here in Chicago, and she was quite a lady. So, you know, they did a great job for us when the men were gone.
Yeah, I've met one of the WASPs myself, and it was a marvelous experience. A great conversation. It wasn't very lengthy; it was maybe 10 minutes or so. But listening to this woman, this B, describe her past and how she viewed all of this was just fascinating. Some amazing women, they did an amazing thing. And yeah, as you say, Rob, they deserve the recognition, and we all deserve to keep that memory alive. All right, one last item. This is from CNN. This is a Chicago story, Chicago O'Hare International Airport. Apparently, hundreds of workers are set to strike on Tuesday, November 29th. Now, I guess some of the airport janitors, baggage handlers, cabin cleaners, wheelchair attendants, people like that, they're paid minimum wage, which is in Illinois, $8.25 an hour. And they want to be paid $15 an hour, so they plan to strike. But the key here is November 29th is after the extremely busy travel holiday of Thanksgiving. So I guess Rob, folks in Chicago or those planning on going through Chicago are glad to hear that they're not going to strike during the holiday.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, my daughter's coming home from school early on Wednesday morning, and I said, I think you might want to just bring a carry-on with you as opposed to checking a bag. But that was before we found out that the strike had been averted. But honestly, the spokesman for the group, which at the moment is not unionized, they're just organized, said, look, we don't want to screw up everybody's travel plans. We want the public to listen to our story and hear what we have to say and perhaps support us. And they were smart enough to know that that would not be the case if they did this in the middle of the Thanksgiving holiday.
Yeah, I think that's to their advantage, I guess. I mean, certainly if they had struck or had planned to strike during the holiday, there would have been a lot of very, very angry people. Maybe that would have helped their cause, maybe not. I tend to prefer go the more sympathetic route and, be accommodating to other people and still make your point. So I think it's a good move on these people's part. Are they looking to unionize, do you know, Rob?
I believe they are. I can't remember which union is working with them, but they have not secured a contract yet.
Again, we're speaking with Andy Bard. He's a second officer at a major Asian airline. Andy, first of all, tell us, what's a second officer?
Well, a second officer, also known as a cruise pilot or a cruise relief pilot, is a pilot at the beginning of his career or her career at the airline. And all we do is cruise relief. So we never take off or land the airplane. Or I should say, if we have to land the airplane, then two people or three people have already died. So on long patterns, we take over once we're at cruising altitude so that the captain and the first officers can get some rest. We also provide cruise relief on some shorter overnight turnarounds where the fatigue just gets a bit too much, even though the flying hours are technically within the flight time limitations.
Hmm. So your aspiration is to eventually move next to become a first officer, is it?
Certainly, and this is all dependent on seniority, on how many are needed. And once my number comes up, if you will, then I will be offered the upgrade course.
Any ideas how long that might take, or does it just vary a lot depending on the circumstances of the seniority effects?
Well, the joke is that every week it varies. You can hear from the fleet office; they'll say 3 years, and then 2 weeks later, it'll be 4 years, and then 3 weeks later, it'll be 2 years. And funnily enough, the first officers have exactly the same conversation about their captain upgrades.
Yeah.
We never really know. And unless I have my pre-interview, I don't know either. Huh. But I'm guessing another few years.
Andy, would it make any difference if you were to change airlines and move to, let's say, another carrier in China or the Middle East? Would that, since you are a real pilot, would that increase your chances, or you're happy where you are and gonna stick through it?
It depends. Some airlines you start directly in the window seat, and so of course that would be an advantage. It's also assuming that my experience at my current airline is significant, because of course if you started an airline as a first officer or a captain, that experience counts towards employment at another airline. As a second officer at many airlines, you're a bit more bound to that airline within a certain period until you upgrade, because you may have a limited rating, as for example we do, with some limitations to it. We do train to obviously land the airplane, do approaches, do all those things that the first officers and captains do when they're flying. However, our rating is still not exactly the same. And so moving across, unless you already have that experience from your previous life, can be difficult. And I think this is one of the reasons also the position exists, in that you're locking in people because you've paid for their training. You don't want them to just say, well, thank you very much for my type rating. I will now go somewhere else. Hmm.
So you received your training through this airline?
I did indeed. I did my commercial on my own, and then I started at the airline with my commercial license and moved on through getting my national rating for where I work and my type rating for the aircraft.
Was there a class of student pilots at the airline that you were part of?
A class of crazies, yes, indeed. And
tell us about the crazies. How many of them were there, roughly? Where do they come from? You know, what are their interests? Tell us a little bit about that class.
I want to start from the beginning by saying that by crazies, I mean fun people and not actual crazy people.
I assume so, yes.
For the record.
Thank goodness you said that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I'd say there are a few levels of getting in. There are those who are the local kids who start with maybe no experience and who are trained from zero by the airline. There are those on the other end who have maybe significant airline experience or from turboprops or jets or military flying, and they do a short course. And then there's sort of those in the middle who have a commercial license, but we do a middle course. So obviously we already know how to fly light aircraft, and some of the guys in my course had significant instructor experience or charter flying experience in, say, King Airs or that sort of aircraft. And then you have the guys like me with just barely enough to scrape by. And, well, it's very much like going back to university, really. You live on campus and you were a tight-knit group of guys. And at the end of our training, about half the people in my class, I hang out with them all the time still. And about half of them I never talk to, because that's what happens when you spend a lot of time with the same people.
Sure.
And I would say that this is going to be interesting, because as we move on, our seniority numbers are all right next to each other. So when it comes time to captain upgrade, and however many years that is, we will all be doing it within the same few months. So it's interesting that you start out with the same people and they're sort of flying formation with you all the way through throughout your career, unless somebody leaves the airline.
Well, you know, I have a question for you, Andy. I mean, when you now you learned to fly in Europe somewhere, did you?
I actually learned to fly in the U.S.
Oh, you did? Oh, yeah. Marvin. So then, did you need to sort of transpose your flight certificate, your pilot certificate, into a different mode, say in the EASA category, or how did that work?
Well, absolutely. I needed to get a license for the country where I work. And you know, to paraphrase that saying about airplanes, when the weight of the paperwork is greater than the weight of the pilot, then you're ready to fly. And so there's a massive amount of bureaucracy. And obviously, they want to tick all the boxes and make sure that you've done it all. So I had to do a lot of exams, and I had to do flight tests on a light twin, which obviously has nothing to do with what I'm flying today, besides having two engines and wings. And then once you're sort of done with all that, then you can get into the simulator and start learning about the actual aircraft that you're going to fly. So there's a significant period of time and a lot of effort spent in license conversion, box ticking, medicals, and all that stuff.
I'm curious to ask what the gender makeup of your class was. Did you have any women in there? Are we making any progress towards increasing the percentage of women pilots?
In my class, we didn't have any women, but there are women. We have some. It's obviously one out of maybe 20, I would say. So I think there's progress being made. I don't think it's very fast. But I think, you know, as we progress, it will, the percentage of women is increasing in commercial aviation.
Well, you know, I'm curious, Andy, when you were living in Europe, how did you hear about this this job at your current airline? Was it just something online, or how'd that all work out?
I was actually living in Asia at the time, working here. So I heard about it basically from friends who were sort of moving in expat circles. And then, so-and-so works at the airline. Why don't you're always asking me about planes and stuff. Why don't you go talk to them? So it was kind of a lucky combination of interest and being in the right place and also having the wherewithal to be able to go and get flight training, because obviously for most guys who want to be airline pilots, that's one of their biggest problems, is that how will I be able to support myself while I, you know, get all these hours and spend all this time doing it.
Well, how much time did you have when you hired on with the airline?
Let's see, about 300 hours.
Okay, and that's kind of the way it used to be here in the States before that ATP rule came together. And,
yes.
But even so, if you learn to fly in the States, well, you still spent a fair penny, not just on the flight training, but on all the license conversion work, I would imagine, correct?
Well, I did have my U.S. license, and then the license conversion was all done once I started on. So, yes, indeed, it was. But it was expensive to get my license, obviously. I would say absolutely this was the way it used to be, and I think despite the ATP rule, in the rest of the world, we're moving towards airline pilots who will start with fewer hours, because the pool of candidates who come from a military background or come from a significant general aviation background is not increasing, probably decreasing. On the other hand, we have an increase in demand for pilots in Asia, and we have an insignificant general aviation in most of Asia. So you will see more and more pilots in the right seat of airliners who have 300 hours, 500 hours, for better or for worse, I would say.
And maybe increasing percentages of those from outside of the region, no doubt.
Absolutely. We do see a large percentage of pilots. I would say most of the pilots in my airline are not from the region, because simply that's where the interest comes from. And if you have local candidates in many of these countries, those will be people who saw an ad in the paper or know someone, and it'll be, well, what shall I do with my life? Shall I become a lawyer? Shall I work in finance? Shall I work somewhere else? Oh, look, there's an ad for an airline pilot. Well, I'll go and apply for that. And so you don't have that traditional thing which you have in Europe or Australia or the US, where you have guys who've always been interested in aviation. They got their first flying lesson at 16 to 18, and then they get their private pilot, and then somebody knows somebody, and this is sort of natural progression. It'll be much more you, who have never been interested in aircraft, or on the other hand, are super interested in aircraft, but there's a much wider range in passion for aviation itself. We do have a significant mix. You have people who have flown off aircraft carriers or have been in national aerobatic teams. And on the other hand, you have these guys who saw an ad in the newspaper and were trained from zero.
This might be a really difficult thing to answer, but do you think there's any difference in the, piloting skills or any other aspect of being a pilot when you look at those who had this longstanding passion for aviation and others who kind of view it more maybe as just, you know, it's a job?
I think that's one of the most talked about subjects in our pilot community. I would say that I share the view from personal experience. I would share the view that is official at the airline that, of course, when you start out, a guy who's flown 3,000 hours of twin otters in northern Canada compared to a guy who has the minimum of experience, the skill level and experience level is very different. However, interestingly, when you talk to captains, they all seem to behave in very much the same way. Their application of procedures is very similar, and their attitude towards risk is very similar as well in the way they do things, their awareness of the situation. So I think as you sort of move up in the ranks and in experience, the difference in experience means less and less. Also, because obviously you've been doing a lot of flying. We do a lot of flying, a lot of thunderstorms. We do winter flying. We do a lot of flying in different conditions. The official line is that after about 2-3 years, the difference in skill level, as they measure it, becomes rather insignificant.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could maybe explain to our audience, you mentioned the word expat. Everybody in our audience may not know what that is and kind of what that culture kind of shakes out like. Can you tell us a little about that?
Certainly. Expat, at its most basic level, is a person who lives outside their culture of birth. So say somebody from California moves to Massachusetts. Jokes aside, it would be more like...
I thought that was... Actually, that's not a bad analogy.
Pretty accurate, but, right?
Yeah,
jokes aside, we have, at my airline, living in Asia, we have Kiwis and Aussies and Yankees and Canucks and Wogs and all these people, all the nicknames, we have them all. And the thing is, we all make up Planet Expat in the community because... this culture is so different from ours. You never really go native. I mean, say a Brit who moves to the US, the cultures are quite similar. And so you have that chance to assimilate. While here, we're always going to be expats in our own eyes and in the eyes of the locals. And there's a tendency for the expat community to become a sort of community within the wider community. So even though I live in a large city, I tend to know people at one remove because the expat community is much smaller than the actual size of the city. And it's a special thing that some people, they come out for 2 years working, say, for a financial company or something like that. And then after a few years, they move back to their home or others move to another expat city and others just stay. It tends to be difficult to know what people are going to do with their lives. But some people really embrace it. And they don't mind being somewhere where there will always be the foreigner. And some people just feel really uncomfortable with it.
Hmm. Yeah, that mirrors my experience with traveling to Asia quite a number of times and spending time with the expats there of various companies. The difference, I guess I could characterize as those who make a concerted effort to – those expats who make a concerted effort to learn the local language seem to be – kind of a different breed than those who have no interest at all in learning any of the local language. And those that do seem to, you know, assimilate more into the local culture or immerse themselves in it or have more friends and relationships in that culture. I always find that very interesting.
This is very, very true. And you'll find that with the pilot profession, it's interesting because you're locked in. Like if you work for, I don't know, a bank, then finding a job that is similar at another place, say back where you came from, is not as hard. If you work for an airline, you've got seniority, and so you've worked for them for 10 years. Leaving, no matter how attractive it may now seem to you, is very difficult career-wise. And so you will find captains who've worked for 15 years, just they can't wait for retirement. And so they've never really, they're sort of living their life on hold for decades.
Wow.
Their apartment may not be furnished properly. It's like they're living in a hotel. A lot of them, their families may be back in their home countries, and so they're commuting. So it can be difficult on the personal life, especially if maybe you want to embrace the culture more, but your spouse doesn't feel as engaged because she basically followed you on your expat adventure. Or you met her while you were back home, and then understanding the expat experience is very difficult unless you've actually lived it.
Mm. And then if you add children into that mix, you know, in addition to a spouse, it's even more complicated.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've flown both the A330 and the A350, correct?
Yes, I have. I'm 350 is, I'm just at the beginning, shall we say, but yes.
So what are your initial impressions with the A350?
It's an amazing airplane. It really is. Just talking economics, I mean, it's fabulous. But also, it's like flying a spaceship because you're sitting there with all your screens and trackball, and it can do some amazing things. Also, a lot of the systems compared to the 330 are quite simplified, like the nuts and bolts, if you say, the flight control system, the hydraulic system. All these things have been, they've taken away a lot of the quirks that used to be. For example, has only two hydraulic systems, plus backup hydraulic actuators. And if you lose both hydraulic systems, you still get the autopilot. So on the 330, I'd be hand flying and sort of trying not to cry as the other guy goes through all the emergency procedures. And here, you know, we still have autopilot. It's just fabulous. So they've done a heck of a job, I must say, with this aircraft. The one difficulty going to it is that the presentation is very advanced, and you can do so much autoflight-wise. I mean, you can click on the navigation display to go around a thunderstorm. You can click on the navigation display and make a pseudo waypoint and put it in your flight plan, like you're drawing something in a drawing program on a PC. So that kind of thing is really useful. However, there's a risk of it being slightly overwhelming in the beginning.
Yeah, and Andy, in our pre-call, we talked about some of the differences between the 330 and the 350 and how it's taking a while to get used to those differences. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. From a pilot standpoint, it's still an Airbus. So the basics of the flight control system and how you interface with the aircraft are the same. The symbology is all practically identical, as in a little hockey stick on the magenta line, which is green. Hockey stick on the green line is still a hockey stick on the green line. It still means the same thing. The knobs on the autopilot control panel still do the same thing. So if you instinctively have the same pattern of work in those things, that'll work for you. But there are slight differences. Like, for example, deceleration light on the 330 is on the autobrake button. So you're looking for it as you land and you go decel. But on the 350, it's on the speed tip. So there's a bit of a transition in the beginning, just going, I'm in a 350. I need to look in a different place for the things that I need to know. Generally, things like that. Also, the interfacing with the electronic flight bag and the performance calculations are done differently. However, a lot of that stuff is less critical because you're not really doing it during flight. So if you have an oopsie, then you're on the ground anyway. But it is a bit of a challenge. But I think as we gain more experience, it'll be easier to understand what those challenges are, and you'll just know, I'm in a 350 today, I'm going to look at certain things. Also, it has a HUD, which is very different. So there's a bit of a transition there, just getting used to having a heads-up display.
An oopsie?
Yeah. An oopsie. If you click the wrong button, which, you know, to be honest, happens in the 330 as well, because mistakes, you know, you punch the wrong button. It happens all the time, and we have procedures that are built in to pick up on mistakes. That's why we cross-check each other. It happens in any multi-pilot environment. If you make a mistake, then you fix it. It's not a big deal.
No, that's true. And it just takes a little while to get used to. I remember when I started flying in glass cockpit airplanes, I would hit buttons, and as soon as I hit it, I'd say, ah, I wasn't supposed to do that, was I? And the captain would look over and go, not really. But he said, how do we fix it? I go, I just hit it again, and it would turn the thing back on. And he'd go, well, that's half the battle right there is knowing how to fix it.
Yeah, and half the one of the things you learn at an airline is how to diplomatically tell the captain that he's done the wrong thing. So you're like, captain, check that. So it's something that going from single pilot to that was the biggest transition, I would say, going from single pilot to multi-pilot. I can learn the airplane systems, and I can learn how to make the airplane do what I want it to do as much as I want. But dealing with another pilot and that interface is the most significant transition when going to airline flying. You really have to learn to use that person and who has which role and how you can help that person in a positive but non-offensive or non-obtrusive way, because sometimes if it's not time critical, you can be like, oh, maybe you should, you want flaps too, you know, as in question, would you like flaps too? And they go, oh, oh, thanks, I was just about to get that, no problem. And sometimes after a while it can be, you know, you really should take flaps too now because we're getting kind of low. So it's that just learning when to say what and how to say it, because as pilot monitoring, you have way more bandwidth to see these things, and it is your role to be the gatekeeper and be the one who doesn't miss the stuff that the pilot flying, who's really busy, has to do.
And I imagine that it helps if you know the captain or the culture that the captain comes from, so you can maybe adjust your approach to these kinds of things appropriately.
Oh, indeed. We do have to adapt to that, of course. In the end, you know, sometimes you just have to have a thick skin, and that's, he didn't mean it that way, or maybe he did, but who cares? So there's that. But certainly an Aussie pilot and a British pilot will behave very differently, and they'll sound different, and they come from different backgrounds. And the airline spends a lot of time trying to make sure we're all standardized, but in the end, we are people, so we're not super standard.
Who would you rather fly with, an Aussie pilot or a Brit?
Ooh, great question.
Oh, wow. A Kiwi, then. option number three. It really depends on the person. You know, I've flown...
Good answer. Good answer.
Yeah. But it is true. I mean, I've had that question before, and people say, oh, isn't that, aren't these guys just... I'm like, well, yeah, there are certain stereotypes which sometimes hold true. I mean, Aussies are very outspoken. There's no filter. The Brits are much more understated. The Canadians are very polite. All these things are true. But on the other hand, I've flown with some great guys from any nationality, and some guys I'm like, well, that was fun, but can we please not do that again soon?
Oh, too much.
Well, you know, something that I'm curious about, Andy, when you fly, do you fly with a lot of Americans over there at the company you're at?
I don't. I think a lot of it has to do with the global taxation in the U.S., simply because in the U.S., unlike most countries, even if you work in a low-tax environment or a lighter tax environment than U.S., you still have to pay the difference to the federal government in the U.S. Now, in any other country, if you don't live there, you don't pay tax. So I think it's difficult for Americans because they don't – simply their net income, what they take home, is not as large as it is for other pilots because they have to send it, some of it home to Uncle Sam. I also think that we have Americans who are based in the U.S. and – I don't see them maybe because they're on another fleet.
Yeah, in the company that I worked for, the expats received a sort of a tax equalization factor into their salary, so they were kept whole, not penalized by that that different tax requirement. But of course, then it costs the company a lot to put an expat out there in the field.
Indeed. However, if you're based in the U.S. with my company, then certainly you live in the U.S., you're employed in the U.S., so it doesn't make any difference for those
right.
guys.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, this has been a really fascinating conversation, Andy. I want to thank you. But maybe just to close it out, if someone who is maybe considering becoming an expat, flying for an airline in another region of the world, can you describe, you know, who would maybe be a good candidate for an expat kind of a pilot position, and also the kind of person who probably should not consider the expat life as a pilot?
I think the most difficult part for many is, are you good at being an expat? Never mind a pilot, because being a pilot, if you're interested, if it's something you work really hard at, and continue to work hard at your entire career, it's something that you can do. I think that the hard part is, are you ready to leave everything you know and live in another country, which is very, very different for decades? Is it something that you would consider, or is it something you're going, well, I'll see, it scares me. Now, being scared is normal, and some guys, they're really apprehensive, and then they come on and they go, this is fantastic. But it's very hard to know whether this adventure will succeed before you actually try it. But I think if you love other cultures, if you're okay with moving somewhere away from home, if you're okay with not having a support network, well, once you have kids, the grandparents are not that close. All these things that we take for granted in our country are turned on end as we're expats. So I think that's something to think very carefully about. On the other hand, if you're 20, 25 years old and single and want to have an adventure, it's an amazing thing to do. And your home country is not going away. You can always go back. And there's no shame in that. So I think it's just the expat thing is something to think very carefully about. On the other hand, we fly great airplanes in a challenging environment. The job's amazing. We go to exotic destinations. All those, I mean, the pilot profession is not as glamorous as it used to be, obviously. But we still have layovers in cool places. It's exotic cities, and all that exists in a way that maybe flying for a European regional airline, you will not get because you're going to the same places that are relatively similar to where you live anyway.
All right. Very good. Well, Andy, again, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been really, really interesting conversation. If any of our listeners have any questions or something they'd like to pursue a little bit more deeply, is there a way that they can get in touch with you?
They can get in touch with me by contacting the show, and I do appreciate you guys helping me about this.
Sure.
So absolutely, just put up on the contact us link on the show, and I'd be happy to answer any questions via email.
Fantastic. Andy, thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, Andy, one of the things, and I think, Rob, I'm not sure if you asked this question before or where it came from, but the quantity of hours that you get to accumulate when you fly aren't counted as full hours. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, if you're a captain or first officer, your hours, well, as a captain, your hours, as long as there's a block hour in there, you're getting it. As a first officer, obviously any flying hour, but with a limited rating in some countries, you do not get the full credit. So like I'd get an hour, I'd fly an hour, but I would only get part of that hour, maybe 2/3 of that hour. And so it just takes a longer time to come up to your ATP requirements. It's just something, it's a regulatory thing. The airline doesn't really think that your hour is worth less than anybody else's hour. I mean, you're still flying the plane and keeping people safe, but it's just yet another regulatory quirk that has to do with being a second officer.
Now here's David Vanderhoof. He's our official Airplane Geeks historian. And I think you have a kind of a timely story for us, David.
Yeah, I think it was time for Susie to go for another flight. I know that we've had some listeners complain about my stories, but we also had as many listeners say they wanted to hear more about Susie, and it's the holidays, so I thought we'd take her for a flight. So this is called Susie and the Turkey Shoot. The weather was getting colder, and the leaves were blowing across the airport. I hate FOD, thought Susie. She also didn't like all the geese. They all seemed to want to occupy the space over the airport at once. Pilot Rob said they were flying south for the winter. Susie thought that they flew in orbits over the field just to make the airplanes unhappy. Geese and airplanes really aren't friendly towards each other. November was a depressing month for Susie. It always seemed like it was no move ever. This year was different. The weather seemed a little warmer, the skies a little bluer. Susie, though, felt trapped in her hangar. It seemed like forever since Pilot Rob had shown up. Like clockwork, it wasn't before she was done that thought, the hangar door opened. "Hello, old girl," Pilot Rob quipped. As usual, Susie thought, "I'm not old." Then that warm feeling came over her as she might get the fact that there's some air between her and the cold concrete slab she had been sitting on for weeks. "Well, how about we go for a flight? I need to get some time in, and I thought we would look at the leaves before they fall to the ground. What do you think?" Pilot Rob was already pushing her out onto the apron. "Yay," thought Susie. "Finally, I'm going flying." Pilot Rob quickly hopped in and pre-flighted her. Susie's excitement built. Before she knew it, she was out on the runway with Pilot Rob calling ATC Ben up in the tower. "Tower to Susie. Hold, we have a ramp vehicle crossing the runway." It was Jenny, the stairs truck. What does that stairs truck do, thought Susie. 2-1 Sierra Zero, you're clear for takeoff. "Have a good flight, Rob," squawked Ben from the tower. Susie's pulse raced as she sped down the runway and she suddenly was up. A sigh of happiness came out of her. The air was chilly but lovely. Pilot Rob banked her towards the north, off in the distance, away from the city were the mountains. She flew towards them and weren't the normal greens. They were reds, yellows, and deep oranges. Not colors she liked to see. All of those meant bad things to her. Danger. Pilot Rob seemed to sense her anxiety. "It's okay, girl. Those colors are nature's way of letting us know it's going to be okay. Orange is the color of fall. It's also the color of sunsets. Yellow is happiness and comfort. Red means warmth and love, and brown means reassurance. I know you get sad this time of year because we don't go flying that much, but it doesn't mean I don't want to." Pilot Rob flew her down a gorge close to the river. She could see on either side of her, up to the sky, was color. Huge patches of deep color. She thought the only color that was important was the blue of the sky. Now she realized that she was quite lucky to look down on the earth from a different perspective. As they broke over the lake, she saw a plane taxiing on the water, and she watched it rev up, and for what seemed forever, fly on the water till it was actually in the air. "Wow, I thought I took long to get airborne," said Susie. She then realized it was Max, high engine from the airport. He always told her that he landed on water. Also, his propeller was on backwards. Susie didn't believe him. Airplanes landing on water was silly. Besides, he had landing gear. How could you land on water with landing gear? She now realized he was really lucky. That was really pretty where he got the land. Suddenly, she became a little jealous. "Okay, it's time for us to go home," Pilot Rob chimed in. He slowly put Susie in a bank and took one last look at the blue lake glistening, surrounded by all that color. "Susie, tomorrow we're going to have some special guests. It's Veterans Day, and I'm going to let a friend borrow you to take her up his hero." "Oh, no," thought Susie. "Not another person to bounce me around the circuit." Before she knew it, Susie was back at the airport, and Pilot Rob had pushed her back in the hangar. "Good night, old girl. See you tomorrow." The hangar closed, and Susie drifted off to sleep. Susie then woke up with a start. The hangar door was going up, and it was Pilot Rob and two other non-pilots. Susie started to get her jitters when she met someone new. "Susie, this is Commander Samuel and his father, Sebastian. We're going to take Sebastian up for a flight," Pilot Rob said in a very matter of fact. They eased her out of the hangar. Pilot Rob and the commander pushed her out of the hangar. Sebastian just watched and stood out of the way. Sebastian was different. He was a little slower than Rob and Samuel. He wore a baseball cap and a very old flight jacket. He carried his stick as a third landing gear. It took both Samuel and Rob to help him get into the right seat. It reminded Susie of the flight of that Christmas before. Pilot Rob climbed in the back and let Samuel take the controls. While he wasn't Pilot Rob, he was pretty good. Susie taxied to the runway. "This is Air Zulu requesting honor flight departure." What's an honor flight, Susie thought. I hope that isn't dangerous. "Sierra Zulu, you're cleared for takeoff," came the response from Ben in the tower. "Have a safe flight and thank you for your service." Susie rolled down the runway up to where she was the happiest, though she did wonder what that honor flight part was all about. Pilot Rob crackled on the radio. "So, Lieutenant JG, what do you think?" Sebastian slowly responded. "She has more pep than my old TBM. I could have gotten to my target a lot quicker with one of these." Susie thought, wow, that must have been a slow airplane. The commander chimed in. "Yeah, Dad, you would have gotten there faster, but then what would you have done? Nothing to drop or shoot." Pilot Rob, "Were you really part of the Marianas turkey shoot?" "Yes," replied Sebastian. "I made a torpedo run on the Imperial Japanese Navy Hero. We hit her hard and she sank into the sea. Above us, Hellcats were ripping apart Zeke's and anything else they could throw at us. I remember how much anxiety and nerves I had when I returned to the Belleau Woods. She was an escort carrier that day, and she seemed smaller to me than ever before, unlike that behemoth my son flew off of." "Yes, Dad, I know you think I had it easier when I flew Tomcats of VF-14 off the Enterprise. So show me how it's done, old man. You have the controls." Susie bounced as Sebastian found the pedals and had his hands on the yoke. Susie thought she heard Pilot Rob whisper, "Nice and easy, Susie. Be gentle." Susie felt the yoke tremble a bit as Sebastian moved the controls. Sebastian retorted, "Don't you forget, I taught you everything you know about flying there, young man." From the black was, "So how does she compare to your Avengers, Sebastian?" "Funny. It's like the guy in the back on the radio and somebody near me who never shuts up," was the reply. "Flies a lot better than a turkey. Okay, Sam, take back the controls. I have command, replied the commander. Dad, it's funny. I just realized that we both flew turkeys for the Navy. Both Grumman aircraft. You got shot at, Les, though, retorted Sebastian. From the back came pilot Rob on the intercom. Shall we go home? With that, Susie flew back to the airport and kept thinking about turkeys. They landed the plane back to the hangar. Commander and Rob helped Sebastian out of the plane. Pilot Rob looked at both the men and shook their hands. Thank you for the service. So how'd I do, Dad? You might outrank this lieutenant junior grade, but I'm still a better pilot and your dad, Commander. They all laughed. And this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
All right. Another Susie story. That's fantastic. Yeah, for those.
And it's no turkey.
Yes, no turkey. Yeah. For those of you who are more recent subscribers to the Airplane Geeks podcast, David does, he does a Susie story. Generally about once a year, David, I guess?
Yeah.
More or less.
When there's something,
when the mood strikes.
When the mood strikes.
Yeah.
Usually around a holiday or something along those lines.
Yeah, very good. Thanks again, David. All right, let's see what's up with the geeks. I'll kick it off. Just mention really briefly, there's an article in the Daily Princetonian about Bede Wilson, the aviation queen. This is Q&A, Bede Wilson, aviation journalist. So we'll put a link in the show notes to this article. Bede really goes into, well, kind of more of her background, how she became known as the aviation queen, and some other interesting things. So that's worth checking out. Let's see. How about the rest of you guys? Brian, anything to report?
I did a quick trip this weekend up to San Francisco and flew on United up and back, and absolutely nothing went wrong. So
yay!
Yeah, no, it was really good. Yeah, flights took off on time, landed on time. Service was really good. There was a bit of rain and thought it's going to get hit with delays. And even with the rain, everything worked okay.
Fantastic. So
It happens.
It does. It does. All right. And David, something about a tail hook?
Yeah, I finally got around to doing something I've wanted to do for a while, which is everybody knows about my Skyhawk tailhook. Well, there's been a lot of people who've visited me over the years and have wanted to have their picture with the tailhook. Well, now if you go to What Just Flew By, you can see all of the people who have visited me and have their tailhook pictures. And the other part about it was, so people don't know I'm nuts, I started putting pictures of all of my friends who are local around here who also have tail hooks. So there's an official order of the A4 tail hook page on my What Just Flew By blog. So if you come to Philly and you give me some notice, you can always come see the tail hook and we'll go out and get cheesesteaks.
Fantastic. Love it.
Wait, there are multiple people in your neighborhood that have tail hooks?
Go to the webpage and you'll see all of my friends who have tail hooks.
Wow. We got to check this out. Okay. Link in the show notes.
Why do you have a tail hook?
Because somebody offered it to me. We actually had a Marine Corps A4 Skyhawk base, which I grew up near. And we had a some crew. Some of the people who have them were actually ground crew for the aircraft. People like me were fortunate enough to know people who had ground. And they just got thrown out when they got overused. So it's a nice thing to have. You know, I'm lucky to have a wife that actually understands that I have a tail hook and there's people who want to visit it.
Yes. No, I see. Yeah, you should try taking it through security at an airport and see what happens.
Yeah, that wouldn't work.
Not going to do that.
No. All right. Let's move on to some listener mail. We have a couple here. We heard from Bo Inventing. Now, Bo calls himself an inventor. He's out of Las Vegas, Nevada, or Nevada, I guess, if you're going to pronounce it as the locals do. He's trying to promote and highlight this concept, his newest invention. He calls it the Razorback. He sent us a short video that describes it. He calls it the best all-weather flyer over water. He's trying to push this to the Coast Guard for possible adoption. He sees different versions of this possible in the future. And as I said, this Razorback concept is captured in this video that we'll put in the show notes. It's, you know, it's always sort of intrigued me how difficult it can be for someone who has some ideas about an airplane that they might like to see get developed and actually built, how difficult that is a process. You know, I don't know, Rob, I suspect that probably most attempts, intended as they are, as good a concept as they are, probably most of them never go very far.
Oh, there are a lot of airplanes that never quite make it. But look at the ones that we do know about, going back to the famous 787 blog that John Ostrower used to write, because he had a whole packet of great info about the troubles that company was going through when they were developing the airplane. The A380 had problems. We certainly know about the C-Series and what Bombardier is going through. And this is just the large aircraft.
Yeah.
But you know, aircraft are more complex now.
F-35s.
Yeah. Yeah, F-35s. They've had a few problems, I guess, David, huh?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it's not just the civilians, it's the military, too.
That's true. And, you know, again, it's not going to get better, I don't think. In fact, I forgot to mention something that I'm going to do next week that kind of can I just throw something in there as if we were still talking about what we're doing?
I guess so.
Well, next week I'm not going to be here because I will be in Germany, going out to fly a new light sport aircraft model that the Rimos folks are building.
Yeah.
And so it's I've got some time in an earlier Rimos. It's a little, you know, light sport. It's very light. It's under, oh gosh, I should know the regulation. 1400 and something, or 1300 and something for the total weight. But it's, again, it's supposed to be a spectacular little airplane. That's the question I'm going to be asking them is, tell me about, you know, what you learned about developing an airplane in the last year or two as you brought this new model to market. And they all have something that just doesn't go the way the designers planned. But we'll see how this one works out.
Hmm. And then we have these supersonic business jet concepts moving forward. I think maybe at least a couple of them. And they look good on paper, I guess. I don't know about the business case, but they kind of look good on paper. But how many of those will we see actually get developed? You know, it's hard to predict.
Well, it is, and now the concept has become a little more interesting because there's competition. And, I mean, after the last Concorde stopped flying, we didn't hear much about supersonic travel for quite a long time. And now the last, the last 3 years, maybe four, it's really back in the news again. So we'll know when the first one takes flight.
Yeah.
I think one of the problems with Concorde was that it really was Mark 1 or Mark 0.9. Even Concorde had the Concorde B development project, which would have extended range, decreased cost significantly. So we only saw the DC-3 of supersonic aircraft in service, and there was no real chance to go beyond that. So I think there's a lot of work that could have been done during the 70s and 80s, and I'm very hopeful for these new prototypes. And there's definitely a market as long as they can get the price down a bit.
Yes. Yeah, I'm always hopeful that the new design, whether it's, you know, Bo with his design or with a supersonic aircraft of whatever type, or a new military jet or a large commercial aircraft, it's always exciting to me when something new is coming along and being developed. It's just difficult for the little guy, I guess we'll say, to make any inroads into that sort of a thing. But
yeah, it's also very hard because airplane infrastructure is built around a tube with wings that typically has two engines, and you're going to have the passengers boarding from one side and the cargo doors from the other side, and you have tugs and all this infrastructure. When you say, well, we're going to build a flying wing, and the airport guys go, yeah, that's really cool, but where are you going to park it?
Yeah.
So there are more costs involved than just the airplane design issues, shall we say.
Yes. All right. And we also received an email, actually a number of photographs from Ian Allen. These are some pretty nice looking aircraft. A few shots, he says, from the open day at Ardmore. David, you know, when I look at these, I don't know what these things are. Are you able to identify? Is that first one we've got there? Is that a Ryan ST?
It is. The first one is actually the thing that Harrison Ford crashed into the golf course.
Right, not the exact plane.
Not the exact plane, but a replica of it, as well as a later version that was flown by the Dutch as a trainer. That's that really nice orange triangle was the Dutch markings in World War II. And they also have a BE-2, which is a biplane, two-place biplane that fought in World War I. You kind of wonder who would get in it and take it over a combat zone, but it's a really lovely recreation by the team that does all of the work for Peter, I'm about to say Johnson, and that's not it. Who did The Lord of the Rings?
Jackson?
Yeah, thank you. Drew a blank there. And the BE-2 was recreated by Peter Jackson's team, who build replica World War I aircraft. They get the plans and they build them from scratch. And really pretty wire and fabric aircraft. I think I surprised Ian when I said nice BE-2, and he was sort of like, everybody gets surprised that I actually know this stuff. So it's a really nice set of photographs. And
what's the third one that we have here? Ian actually sent us several more, but what's this silver monoplane, low wing?
Is that with the orange? That's the Ryan with spats.
That's a Ryan with spats?
Yeah. The difference
a different
is,
Ryan.
I mean, well, okay.
It doesn't have the same engine.
No. Everything from the engine back is pretty much the same airplane, except that the Dutch one, which has got the orange triangle and the orange logos, is got a inline engine instead of a radial. The one in the American markings has a cowled radial engine on it, whereas the other Ryan, the Dutch one, actually has an inline engine and spats on the landing gear. So they're both Ryans. I think one's an RST. The Dutch one is. I'll have to look it up.
All right. Well, if you find that answer quickly, let me know. We'll put that caption in the show notes. But otherwise, we'll put some of these photos in the show notes, and they really are beautiful airplanes. So visit airplanegeeks.com/428 for this episode to see those and the videos and links to the news stories we talk about.
It's a Ryan ST, or otherwise known as a PT-20. The one with the radial engine is a PT-22 Recruit, which was the U.S. military one. The STM-62 is the one with spats and the Dutch markings.
Great. Okay, good. All right. Well, that's about it for this episode. We want to thank all of you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We really appreciate it. Our guest was Andy Bard, second officer at a major Asian airline. Andy, thanks so much for coming on the show once again.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as we mentioned before, if you've got any questions for Andy that you'd like to pass along to him, just write us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com and we'll forward that to Andy. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. Brian Coleman, we'll start with you. How do folks reach you?
The best place to get a hold of me is at brian@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, if anyone's looking for past episodes of Airplane Geeks podcast, go to airplanegeeks.com/archives.
Great. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. And of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, on the UAV Digest, droning on about UAVs.
And in fact, in this week's episode, which will come out on Friday, Dave and I were joined by Max Trescott. Now, Max was traveling today, so he couldn't make this episode, but you can catch him this week on the UAV Digest. He did really well, David. I think he did better than we usually do.
Yeah, well, you know, it was ironically, he goes, I don't have enough to talk about for 30 minutes. And we tried to stop him at 40.
That's
so
right.
It's a good show. And if you haven't given it a chance, give it a chance, because we do talk a lot as pilots and we'd love to hear our input. And I guess, Max, we should get them to mention that they should come on our Slack listener team, huh?
That's right. If you'd like to join our listener team, we have this little community on Slack, which is used by a lot of people, a lot of companies, actually, as a sort of a messaging platform. But what it really is a little community where it's kind of just us, folks from Airplane Geeks, the podcast, the listeners, and so forth. And so it's very focused on aviation. It's spam free. You don't have a lot of, you know, people coming in there from left field with stuff that you don't really want to waste your time looking at or reading. If you'd like to learn more about it, it's an invitation only community. So you can learn more at airplanegeeks.com/team, and that'll give you instructions on how to get an invite into the community. All right, our intro music, yes, he's back, is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. Find more of his compositions at brunomassone.com.
How about me?
How about Rob? Oh, I forgot Rob. Rob, sorry, Rob. Sorry, Rob, I got ahead of myself. So, Rob, yeah. where can listeners find you?
Gobble, gobble. They can find me any place that mentions Jetwine in the title somewhere, and also at flyingmag.com online, or the print edition of Flying Magazine available at the newsstand.
Yes, it is. So I'm sorry, I forgot. I guess I was trying to finish too quickly. All right, so now it's time to say please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Thanks for listening.